journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Real minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, May 30th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
Silence is not an option.
Victor Jara's widow Joan reflects on justice for her husband's murder in Chile. Stand-up comedian Bill Santiago on his new book, Pardon My Spanglish, and a new documentary, Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. On Monday of this week, a judge in Chile ordered the arrest of nearly 100 former members of the Chilean military and police on charges of aggravated kidnapping in an unprecedented move. 98 people in all, including civilians, were detained in the largest mass arrest for human rights abuses committed during the Pinochet dictatorship. The charges in the case center on the kidnapping and killing of 42 people in 1974 in what was known as Operation Colombo. As investigations continue in the case, demonstrators took to the streets also on Monday to demand the reopening of another human rights case stemming from the dictatorship, which was recently declared closed. Judge Juan Eduardo Fuentes ruled on May 15th that retired Colonel Mario Manriquez was the sole perpetrator in the murder of renowned Chilean folk singer Victor Jara in the days following the September 11, 1973 coup. Manriquez, who was found guilty of first-degree murder, was the commanding officer at Estadio Chile, where Jara and thousands of others were detained. But he was not the gunman who actually fired the bullets that killed the legendary singer. The Jara family met with Judge Fuentes on Wednesday to demand that the case be reopened to find all responsible parties in the interests of justice for Victor Jara and for Chile. Uprising producer Gabriel San Roman spoke with Joan Jara, widow of the late Victor Jara, about the case and the Justice for Victor Jara campaign.
My first question is, what was the initial reaction from your family in response to Judge Fuentes' ruling that held only one person responsible for the death of Victor Jara and declared the case closed?
Well, we were shocked and surprised. I mean, it was out of the blue, this decision of the judge, as far as we were concerned. You understand that this is a case that has been going on for years and years. The initial case was presented in 1978, during the military dictatorship. Of course, that didn't get anywhere at all. That was shut down. This one was reopened after the arrest of Pinochet in London, together with many other people. Human rights cases. We were surprised and shocked. We began immediately to react to this, take measures, express this to the media, to ask for support from our friends all over the world who would sign a petition that it should be reopened. And really, we have been active since this case was shut down in a different way. I mean, we had the support of artists from different countries all over Chile. We presented almost between 12 and 20,000 different petitions. We haven't actually been able to count them all yet for the case to be reopened.
Do you have plans to appeal the decision? And what is the legal strategy at this point? And what do you believe its prospects are?
Yeah, well, our first strategy was one of protest. And this, we had an extraordinary amount of support. Our foundation really is a very active foundation, and has many friends all over the world. And we have been receiving hundreds of signatures and emails from different countries, United States, Pakistan, Europe, and of course, very much so, United Kingdom. In Chile, many people have been active here to protest against the closing of the case. several hundred people accompanied us to the tribunals last Monday, where there was a sort of an artistic performance just outside the tribunals to ask for the reopening of the case. And we accompanied our lawyer to the tribunals to formally ask for the reopening of the case, and were received by the judge who had closed it, who seems to be convinced that it has to be reopened. Meanwhile, and we made an appeal to the 5,000 prisoners who were there in the stadium with Victor to come forward, and if they had anything, any contribution to make in the identification of the military people from different branches of the armed forces who were active there in the stadium, to come and give their testimony. Because many people, I think, have thought that what they knew wasn't so important. But we have asked now for perhaps people who were conscripts at that time, who were in the stadium as guards. Now, many of these people perhaps will be able to identify their officers. And we have had some response to this. And many people have come forward with information to the foundation. And this we have passed on to the judge who is in the investigating judge who is in charge of the case. And we are optimistic that we made a big step forward since the case was closed. Perhaps it was actually quite positive, because in that sense there has been a very, very big reaction to this. And people who have never been in touch with us or have never given us any information are coming forward to give us information.
Now in your book, An Unfinished Song, you speak about a figure named The Prince.
Yeah.
Who was at Chile Stadium, where Victor Jara and thousands of others were detained. Why did the trial and years of investigation fail to identify this figure, who is said to have been the actual gunman?
Well, there has been an extraordinary amount of secrecy in the armed forces about the identities of the officers who were active in the stadium. The only officer who has been detained and or say been identified and processed has been Coronel Manriquez Bravo, who was the official who was actually in charge of the stadium. But in the stadium there were many other members of the armed forces acting. And among these, many ex-prisoners have identified one particular one who they have described physically. And there seems to be no doubt that he was the officer who actually tortured and killed Victor. There may have been others involved. We don't know. We don't know for certain. But our job now is to appeal also to the armed forces to give more information about the identity of the different officials who were active in the stadium. Now, where there has always been a veil of secrecy, because very terrible things happened in the stadium, and there has always been a very strong veil of secrecy about the identity of the officers who were there. But little by little, information is appearing. Different officers have been there, been given different names. It all has to be investigated. But there has been a flood of information now that there hasn't been during all these months that the case was open.
And I just want to take this moment to remind listeners that I have on the phone with me Joanne Jara, the widow of Victor Jara, and also the founder of the Victor Jara Foundation in Santiago, Chile. And we're talking about the recent court decision earlier this month that closed the case of Victor Jara, and the protests that have followed and the appeal that has also followed. Now, to follow up, 2 years ago on our program, we covered a public demonstration and confrontation with a person named Edwin Dimter. Protesters, including your daughter, as it was reported, confronted this person at the Department of Labor office where he worked at, and the demonstrators there fingered him as the prince figure. What did the trial say or not say about this person?
I think he was interrogated. He admitted to being in the stadium, but he was never processed. I don't think we have the 100% certainty that he is the was responsible for the assassination of Victor. This has to be further investigated. He was one of the officials, the military people, who had taken part in a failed military coup in June 1973 and who were imprisoned by Allende's regime for treason, obviously, in the attempt to overthrow the government. And they were released on, these officials were released on the 11th of September and allowed to go, or sent to the Chile Stadium to do their will with their prisoners. Dimter is one of them. But we haven't got the certain identification that he was the author of the crime of killing Victor.
Now, the case of Victor Jara is the most well-known and perhaps the most emblematic example of the repression that followed the coup of September 11th. Given that, what does this outcome, this trial outcome, initial outcome, mean for truth, justice, and reconciliation in Chile following the end of this dictatorship?
Yes, well, Victor's case has been called emblematic, has been called a sort of symbolic case. I don't really believe that there can be symbolic cases of homicides, yeah? I mean, I think each homicide is as important as another one. But it's true that Victor was a symbol of, for many years, and in many different countries also, like a symbol of the repression and the violation of human rights in Chile. In that sense, his case must be solved. There must be truth and justice in the case of Victor, because there are so many other cases waiting behind this that will just be forgotten, you know. And this is which makes us even more, it makes it even more important to resolve the case of Victor's murder. Now, in that sense, we are all conscious that there are so many other cases that have never been solved.
Now, you founded the, and we've spoken about the Victor Jara Foundation, but the campaign for justice for Victor Jara is also the campaign for justice for Chile. How has the campaign mobilized people in the wake of the case closing?
How is it mobilized people? It's mobilized, I may say it's mobilized the media in Chile, which is important.
And how has the media in Chile responded to the news and to the campaign?
There has been enormous coverage. I'm glad to say there has been a general, interest in the world, but a reaction to this closing of Victor's case. Because it is a symbolic case, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there has been an outcry here. Huh?
And Victor Jara, as we've mentioned in this conversation, as a symbol, he will also be a symbol of justice and freedom for generations to come. How have you seen his music and living example engaging young people in your country who perhaps were even born after the dictatorship?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we have been forced somehow. The whole weight of history has fallen on us with this closing of the case, yeah, of Victor. We have had to go back 35 years, yeah. In our foundation, and it has always been my feeling since I wrote the book about Victor's life, An Unfinished Song, that Victor's death cannot wipe out the memory of his life. And so the foundation, the whole reason of the foundation was to bring back the memory of Victor as a man, as an artist. He was always present during the dictatorship, but in a clandestine way. And the foundation has sort of rescued him for that clandestinity. And now Victor is very, very present. He's almost a live presence in Chile among young people. And they sing his songs, and they take him as an example of an artist who was committed to social justice, who was courageous in that sense, who really gave his life in all sorts of ways. I mean, his time, his life, his ability to teach, yeah, to in working. He said, I'm a man happy to live at this moment. I'm happy because when one gives one reason, one's will and one's heart to work for the service of the people, one feels the happiness of being reborn. And really that was the the victim's motivation in the last, especially in the last 3 years of his life during the Popular Unity government. And his songs live on today, and young people sing them. Sometimes they put their own music to them, and we have Victor's texts with hip-hop or all sorts of different styles of music, but their content is valid today here in Chile. And Victor is a very... He's an example that brings people together. And I think he's an example who gives young people a motivation and courage to not be content with the world as it is today, but to think that they can actually produce a difference to make a better world. And I think that is what Victor is, his role here in today, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not even only in Chile, but in other countries too. And, well, this is, Victor somehow goes on living in that sense today.
Well, Joanne Jara, I'd like to thank you very much for your time.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm sorry I'm not more eloquent. I don't really speak English anymore. Yeah, okay.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much again.
No, thank you.
Joan Jara, the widow of the legendary Chilean folk singer Victor Jara, speaking with Uprising producer Gabriel San Roman. For more information, visit fundacionvictorjara.cl. You are listening to Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by the filmmakers of a new film opening today, Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American. And we'll hear an interview with Bill Santiago, stand-up comedian, about his new book, Pardon My Spanglish. But first, this week's Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about U.S. imperialism and Latin America.
Like all imperialists, the United States seeks to dismember those nations it cannot control. The idea is to divide the country into bite-sized pieces, some of which can be dominated by groups that are more friendly to imperial interests than the population as a whole. The British pulled this trick off by separating oil-rich Kuwait from Iraq after World War I. The Americans are still toying with the idea of cutting the rest of Iraq up into manageable pieces, the better to extract oil deals from the smaller entities. Now, with much of Latin America floating out of the U.S. orbit, secessionist movements are suddenly popping up in the three most independent nations of mainland South America, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. It is no coincidence that the secessionists are all centered in these Andean nations' oil and natural gas-rich provinces, or that the organizers are rich businessmen with close ties to the United States, or that the secessionists are all emerging simultaneously, or that it just happens that the United States this month reactivated its old Fourth Fleet, which used to enforce American gunboat diplomacy before being shut down 60 years ago. Back when Teddy Roosevelt was president at the turn of the 20th century, the U.S. was having difficulties squeezing a bargain basement deal out of Colombia, which controlled the Isthmus of Panama, through which the Americans wanted to build a canal. No problem. President Roosevelt simply encouraged locals in the region to declare independence, call themselves the Republic of Panama, and then invite in the American Fourth Fleet. All it took was one gunboat to keep the tiny Colombian Navy from reclaiming its territory long enough for the Americans to send in troops. A new mini-nation was born. Actually, a new colony of the United States, at the expense of the sovereignty of Colombia. Explaining later how he got access to the route for the Panama Canal, Roosevelt said, simply, "I took it." Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia aren't about to let some fat, unpatriotic businessmen steal the most valuable portions of their nations in order to cut a separate deal with Washington, and the U.S. doesn't have the power, credibility, or moral authority to come to the aid of its opportunistic friends. But the Americans can stir things up sufficiently to create the threat of civil war, which can be the cruelest punishment inflicted on any nation. Civil wars, like no others, unleash savageries that often do not heal for generations. Colombia is still in a civil war that, by some reckoning, began in 1948. No wonder Colombia has the world's highest murder rate. Its society has been destroyed over and over again by civil war, never having a chance to recover. The United States doesn't care what disasters might result from encouraging secessionists in Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. For Washington, it's just another superpower move on the global chessboard. But Washington shouldn't be surprised to wake up one day and find that no one in Latin America wants anything to do with the Yankees, who toy with the fates of nations as if they were playthings. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. Stand-up comedian Bill Santiago has a new book out called Pardon My Spanglish, ¿Por qué? Because, One Man's Guide to Speaking the Habla. The New York-based Puerto Rican comic appeared earlier this month on Comedy Central for a special called Spanglish 101. Santiago turned his stand-up act about Spanglish into this new book to provoke, quote, laughs for Latinos and the Latino curious. Santiago specializes in political satire and also writes for Mother Jones magazine. He'll be performing and launching his book this weekend at Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights. The show starts tonight and tomorrow night at 8 p.m. and we'll give details of that event, of those events, later. Santiago will be joined by Rick Najera with his performance Daddy Diaries. I spoke yesterday with Bill Santiago about his book, Pardon My Spanglish. Hola, Bill.
Hello.
Bienvenidos a Uprising.
Un placer estar aquí contigo.
Let's talk about your book, which is called Pardon My Spanglish. How do you define Spanglish for those people who have never heard the term? They've probably heard the language, but they don't know what it's called.
Well, I tell you, I wrote a whole book on it, and I still don't know how to define it. It's really a hard thing to pin down. But my personal definition of it is, any time that the two languages, English and Spanish, are engaging together in a way that they combine as if it were one language, that is Spanglish for me. In any sort of environment, in any sort of conversation, in any sort of written format. Some people say it's just a slang or a dialect, or some people reduce it to just those funny adapted words like roof becoming rufo. Instead of saying, I'm watching TV, estoy watching la TV, you know, and they inflect it a little bit with the accent. But I think it's a lot more than that. I think it's the formation of something new with a very active engagement between English and Spanish. That doesn't help you at all, is it?
Well,
boy, that was roundabout. It didn't help you at all.
Let's explore that a little bit further. Now, English and Spanish are two very different languages. They have different structure. How does one blend these two languages? Is it something when people speak Spanglish that they are processing within their brains, or does it come naturally if you're fluent in both languages?
You're not aware that you're doing it.
Okay.
It comes up very naturally because you're trying to communicate. The effort is to communicate a certain meaning, just to say something, and those languages combine to get that meaning across in the most effective way. And effective doesn't always mean the most efficient way. It means the most accurate way, and sometimes one language will provide a certain word, a certain phrase that makes more sense, that is a little bit more on point with what you're trying to say.
So because you have both languages at your disposal, you can be more expressive?
Yeah, you know what it's like sometimes? Honestly, I try to figure out how it is that it works in my mind, and I listen to other people, and I talk about how they do it. And I think it's a lot like, you know, when you have those lottery drawings, you know, and you'll have all those little balls inside the machine, and one of them will pop up and another one will pop up. When you're speaking Spanglish, when you have both languages available to you, you have both vocabularies,
mm-hmm.
and you're not sure which word is going to pop up in what language.
And it just happens.
It just happens, and trying to recreate it is very difficult. But what I try to do in the act and in the book is come up with a whole lot of examples as humorous as possible that will illustrate the points, which, for instance, I'll say, Spanglish is actually much more sophisticated than people expect. A good Spanglish speaker will say something first in English because it's very direct and to the point, and they will add something in Spanish to elaborate.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks he's all that, como si fuera la última Coca-Cola del desierto.
Okay.
And that is the way that people do it. And I don't know if you understood that second part. But just
I got the sense, though.
The sense comes across, yeah. Even if you don't understand it. But someone who does understand it, you know, it opens up. I mean, that's where the good stuff is. That's really what you intended to say. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of, it's an impulse that comes up inside of you, and it is everywhere.
Okay.
The languages are combining like this all around you, and you're not even aware of it.
No, but of course, the United States, it's a diverse country, and the Latino population in the United States is also diverse. How commonly is Spanglish spoken?
Well, it's unprecedented, and this is the first official or unofficial, however you want to call it, Spanglish-speaking country. This is where it's really happening more than any place else, because you have this huge, huge torrential apocalyptic wave of Latinos, you know, and their first generation children. So they're brought up in Spanish speaking mentality and households and environments and neighborhoods, and they're watching that in the media, but they're suddenly infused into an English space, and those things are combining like these two very vibrant tributaries of not just language but culture. References, ways of thinking, you know, language formats, the way that you think, and these things are coming out in one expression. And, you know, I grew up with it, and I thought it was something that just my family did, that just people that I knew around me did, and I was never aware of it. I didn't know it was happening. You'd be at the dinner table and someone say, would you like some more? No, gracias, estoy full, you know? And that would be perfectly natural. And my parents were talking like that, my grandparents, and it was just very, very common.
So it's not generation-specific?
There's a curve. It's not generation-specific. You know, what changes is the ratios of each language that are spoken in that combination, you know? And that's actually very interesting. For instance, if you were born in a Latin-speaking country and you come here, you will have a much higher ratio of Spanish in the way that you mix, and the words that you use will reflect the fact that you're a native Latin American-born Spanish speaker. And then someone who was born here will be a lot more facile in English. And as those generations progress and as the education in one language or the other progress, you'll see that shift. And yet, both of these generations are communicating with each other within that Spanglish space at all that overlap. And you'll have several generations all speaking together, and someone who doesn't even speak any Spanish will still be understanding all the Spanish that's being spoken to, and they'll be speaking in English, but their older generation will be speaking to them totally in Spanish, and in the middle you'll have someone who's sort of in between speaking both more or less 50-50, and they're all understanding each other. No one's thinking about it twice. It's just a free-for-all between the languages. And I think that is a very classic case of a Spanglish environment.
Now, does Spanglish have rules like other languages? Can one speak Spanglish badly?
Yes! I had no idea how badly it could be spoken, but I was, or how badly it could be written, but I was called in as a Spanglish consultant for Nickelodeon, you know, and they wanted
You're serious?
Yes! There was a script and
a Spanglish consultant?
Yes, I couldn't believe it either, but that's what they actually put on the check. I think I had the first one ever. And it's framed, it's on my wall. And they were doing some sort of like animated script, and there was a character in the script, and his name was Spanglish. So they wanted to vet the Spanglish. And there was one very funny instance of it where the character said something, have you perdiste your mind? You know? And it sounded so forced, so artificial to me. Mm. And when people try to do it and it comes off in a very unnatural way, you know, you hear the fabric of space-time tearing. It's that grating to your ears.
Mm. Now, what is your critique of language purists on both sides of the aisle who feel that either English or Spanish are diluted by being mixed?
These are people who are in total denial about how languages actually formed in the first place.
And did you study the mechanics of linguistics in researching this book?
No! Well, not formally, but in order to have an understanding of what was going on, let me tell you the process of, for me, okay?
Sure.
I was very interested in it, and once I figured out that it was a thing, you know, once Spanglish became a term with meaning for me, I became obsessed with how often I hear it and why I hear it, why people do it, when they do it, why they're doing it the way they do it, why they're switching on those words. What is going on? What are the triggers? You know, they're emotional, they're mental, they're environmental.
Mm-hmm.
If you suddenly hear a piece of Spanish music, you're in a different mind frame, you know, and it depends on where you are, who's around. If someone starts speaking Spanish to you, do you instantly switch into Spanish? On what word do you switch into Spanish? Once you switch into Spanish, when do you switch back? And these are all very definable and, researchable patterns, but no one has done it. So what I did was I started taping people, you know, my friends, my family.
With their knowledge?
Strangers. No, because that stymies the whole thing. You know, they suddenly become very self-conscious, and Spanglish is a little bit like flying in a dream. Once you realize you're doing it, you know, you can't do it.
Mm.
You know, you fall out of the sky, you wake up, you know, you can't be self-conscious about it. Very hard to recreate, so I would tape everybody without their knowledge.
Did you ever tell them then after the fact?
No, they're all going to find out with this book when it comes out, because these are real-world examples.
Do Spanglish speakers deny that they speak Spanglish?
Very often. I never do that. Yo hablando Spanglish. Who are you kidding?
I'm speaking with Bill Santiago about his new book, Pardon My Spanglish. And by the way, he is going to be at Casa 0101 this Friday and Saturday, May 30th and 31st at 8 p.m. It's the unofficial launch of his book. That Casa 0101 is at 2009 East 1st Street in L.A., 2009 East 1st Street in L.A., May 30th and 31st at 8 p.m. You can call 323-263-7000 7684 for tickets. Again, 323-263-7684 for tickets. Now, Bill, this book is also part of, or based on rather, an act on the same by the same name.
Yeah, I'm a stand-up, and the act is Pardon My Spanglish. I guess that's where I got that title. Anyway, it's the material that I do for Latino audiences, and it became a Comedy Central special, and so. The book people found me, and we turned it into a book, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So this weekend's event will be including that act?
Yeah, it's going to be all a huge Spanglish free-for-all. And I'm on the bill with Rick Najera, who is the creative genius behind Latino Logs, which had a Broadway run. I don't know what I'm doing mixing two languages. I really can't handle one. But he's great. I'm looking forward to performing with him, and it's going to be a wonderful show. Casa, they call it 101, but there's an O in front of it, O101. Mm. So it's casao101.org if you want to reserve your tickets. And please do. There's a couple tickets left.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the book itself.
I feel like we haven't even gotten to it. It's such a hard thing to get into.
Well, the meat of the book is you basically have a bunch of rules for speaking Spanish.
I have a whole section of rules.
A whole section on rules. But your rule number one, which doesn't actually come near the beginning of the set of rules, is that all Spanglish rules are subject to change.
Yes!
Why?
It's a free-for-all because none of it is in none of it is set in stone.
Okay.
You know, this is a language in formation like all other languages, and I really think that, you know, we are privileged in this country to be witnesses to something so new. How often do you get to see it and hear it all around you forming into something new? You hear it in advertising. You know, I heard this, I swear to God, this was a commercial I heard. La nueva variety bucket de Kentucky Fried Chicken. Cada pedacito de pollo frito es that finger licking delicioso. You know, I heard it right here in L.A.
Well, L.A. is a great place for Spanglish on the radio in particular.
Well, radio is one of the greatest formats for it. You know, all those reggaeton stations, all the DJs, mm-hmm. they're going back and forth. And you think they're thinking about it? No, they're just doing it. It just comes from the environment, you know. Mm.
So certain English words, as you just mentioned, get Spanishized into Spanglish, and then there are also, you know, English words that get adopted the other way around. So how
goes
does that work?
Ways.
Yeah, give us some examples.
Let me see. Okay, well, for instance, you'll hear a lot of the words that make it into the English language from other cultures, in this case, the Latino culture. You know, they start with the food. You know, when you hear people say jalapeño, that ñ sound, the ñ, people never get it wrong. You never hear anybody in English say jalapeno.
That's true.
They got that ñ down, and that's a huge entry point into the Spanish language. They don't even know they're doing it, but they would never say it wrong. So that unleashes this whole different space within themselves that allows for Spanish to take place because the ñ is pivotal, you know? I'll give you an example of how pivotal and how critical it is to the culture. I saw a display in a bookstore for Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Cien Años de Soledad, but they have forgotten the ñ. So instead of Cien Años, it read Cien Anos de Soledad.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of 100 years of solitude, now it means 100 lonely anuses, which is an entirely different book. That's how critical it is of the language. You don't want to make those kinds of mistakes. But once you allow for that, you know, things can really take place. People adopt the food terms all the time, like guac from guacamole. Right? You never hear non-Latinos saying guacamole. They have to say guac. Oh, man, that guac was awesome. Right? Oh, I need some more guac. I think I got a little guac on my chin.
Speaking of non-Latinos, you have an entire chapter in your book on the term gringo.
Yeah, I try to avoid the term gringo.
What's the big deal with that word?
I don't know. Some people take offense to it. Some people take a great amount of pride in it, you know.
And can gringos speak Spanglish?
Oh, yeah. They're great. They take it to a... I mean, they come up with combinations that you would never think of.
So it's legit?
Yeah, it is legit. A lot of it takes place in the non-Spanish-speaking world. For instance, I'll give you an advertisement that I saw recently also in California. It was a print ad, a huge billboard, and it was for some sort of cable company, some triple play, a Comcast triple play, you know, where they offer everything. So you get your cable, your telephone, and your TV all bundled up into one. So it was the tag was... get the whole enchilada for next to nada. You don't think I pulled over and wrote that down? That's in the book. I mean, you know, it just takes place. Takes place like that. You hear people say "no problemo" all the time. I mean, a lot of it is very simple, and you do have choices. For instance, this is a little What time does this air?
8 a.m.
Okay, well, whatever. So you would have a choice in Spanish between saying "estoy PMSing" or "estoy PMSando," right? It all depends on when you do it, but you can get very, very creative.
Okay, Bill, you actually write your book, pardon my Spanglish, in Spanglish.
The first one to do it.
I was really hoping that this interview would be conducted entirely in Spanglish, but
it would help if you spoke some Spanish.
Exactly, I'm greatly hampered by that. But could you, for our listeners, read an excerpt of your Spanglish book?
I haven't read any of it before. All right, this is from a section, Your Spanglish Journey. I don't know how... habla savvy you are, quizás you've never even heard of Spanglish before, or never thought about it much, or never realized how much it was going on all around you en un day-to-day basis. Or maybe, ni siquiera te hayas dado cuenta de how much ya lo estabas talking yourself. Maybe you're already proficient, pero deseas greater Spanglishicity. El asunto es que whether you just want to learn what Spanglish is, shoot the breeze informally, cuando estés chilaxeando con tus Spanglish peeps, or be the first Spanglish translator at Las Naciones Unidas, my mission is to empower your every step por el camino to Spanglish journey.
And that is Bill Santiago, stand-up comedian and author of Pardon My Spanglish, Porque Because, One Man's Guide to Speaking the Habla. He's going to be performing tonight and tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at Casa 0101. You can find out more on his website, billsantiago.com. You're listening to Uprising, and after this radical day in history, we'll hear about a new film, Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American.
What is the relationship between education and the courts? Two Los Angeles bench officers will provide an insight into their work. Join John Crumshaw for a special edition of Politics or Pedagogy on Saturday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Also on the agenda, the positive effects of service learning projects in the schools and the unprecedented work stoppage planned by Los Angeles teachers next week. All that and more on Politics or Pedagogy, Saturday, May 31st at 1 o'clock.
People! People of the town.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George, On this day, May 30th in 1741, the British colony of New York was in the middle of executing 34 people who had been found guilty of plotting a slave uprising in the New York conspiracy trials. At that time, blacks made up approximately 18% of the colony's population. New York's white elite, haunted by memories of a slave uprising almost 30 years before, feared losing control of the slave population. When a series of fires broke out in Lower Manhattan, rumors of a massive slave rebellion led to widespread panic. The hysteria, fueled by racist fears, resulted in the arrest of 152 slaves, 30 of whom were either hanged or burned at the stake along with four whites. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. Much has been made in recent years about the use of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs by American athletes. Revelations of baseball stars Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds using steroids raised the profile of such drug use so high that the U.S. Congress held days of hearings on the issue. But what most professional athletes who admit using them say is that everyone does it. Steroid use is more common than not. Now, a new documentary from the producers of Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11 called Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American, digs deep into the issue from the perspective of a former user who has sworn off steroids, but whose brothers continue to use them. Christopher Bell and his two brothers grew up idolizing professional wrestlers and bodybuilders like Hulk Hogan, Sylvester Stallone, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, all of whom used steroids to achieve their bulk and strength. Bigger, Stronger, Faster also reflects on steroid use as a metaphor for modern American life and the mentality that this country emphasizes winning at all costs, whether in the arena of sports, business, or war. What Chris Bell, who has written and directed the film, asks is, when you discover that your heroes have broken all the rules, do you follow the rules? Or do you follow your heroes? Ultimately, he asks, are we a nation on steroids? Chris Bell joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Chris. Hi, are you with us, Chris? Okay, we'll be getting Chris in just a moment. But in studio with us also are the writers and producers, Alex Buono and Tamsin Rawadi. Alex is also the director of photography. Welcome, Alex and Tamsin.
Hi, thanks for having
me. While we're getting Chris on with us, let me just... Actually, Chris, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, okay, great. Glad to hear you with us. So from having watched your film, and I'll get to Alex and Tamsin in just a moment, but Chris, what was your main motivation in making this film that really, in a way, you expose yourself, you expose your brothers, it's very personal. Why did you make this film?
I just thought it was a very important subject matter, and, you know, the topic of steroids started to come to a boiling point, and, you know, we started hearing whispers of baseball players using performance-enhancing drugs, and it's been going on, you know, in my family for a long time, and I knew a lot about it. So I just wanted to explore the issue from the inside out and kind of show America what was really going on.
Hmm. And from your perspective, do you think that, you know, clearly you show from your film that the issue of steroid use, on the one hand, you call it cheating, but you also show that it has been, in a way, blown out of proportion, that the congressional hysteria over it.
It's a very confusing issue. I mean, on one hand, you know, we have rules in sports, and if you break those rules, I guess you would be cheating. However, the drug tests are really bad, and there's no test for human growth hormone. So, you know, we don't know what athletes are actually putting in their bodies to perform better. So it is a very complex topic.
Hmm. Tamsin and Alex, from what is the metaphor that you see this film making about the United States as a whole?
First of all, it's a subject that, you know...
One second, we're sure. Just trying to... Go ahead.
For Tamsin and I coming into the subject, we don't have the same background as Chris, who has been a powerlifter his whole life. We were much more interested in how the issue of steroids in sports could serve as a metaphor for a culture that is really obsessed with winning and with winning at all cost. And... steroids is a great example in the world of sports and athletics of something that's going on in business and politics and war, and that is this sort of message that's sent to us that being the best is what's important, and so many of the winners in our culture are really getting ahead by bending the rules or breaking the rules, and we find that it's sort of a double standard and a bit of a hypocritical perspective to then look at these athletes and say, hey, you know, to demonize the athletes for doing what essentially the rest of us are being promoted to do.
Hmm. And Tamsin, from your perspective, what did you learn about steroid use and some of the things that Alex and Chris have been saying that you didn't know about before? I mean, I felt like I learned a lot of things.
Oh, absolutely. I really knew very little when I started the project. I wasn't really interested in steroids and even really professional athletics that much. I'm not really into watching, you know, the Super Bowl. And what was so interesting for me is the personal stories, Chris and his brothers talking so openly about what led them to use steroids. And when I was watching the congressional hearings, that's what I felt was missing most, is it was all about pointing fingers at these athletes, tearing down these heroes to these people. And they never really asked, it never felt like they asked why people were using steroids. And so I felt like, you know, we really wanted to dig deep into why people were doing it.
Mm. I want to play an excerpt from the documentary for our listeners, which, by the way, is opening today. It's been reviewed very well by the LA Times and New York Times, very widely reviewed. It's opening in Pasadena at the Playhouse 7, Los Angeles at the Landmark, Hollywood at the Arclight Hollywood 15, and in Irvine at University Town Center 6 Cinemas. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from the film Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American.
I think steroids are as American as apple pie.
We live in a society today that you got MTV and reality shows. Madonna's making out with Britney Spears. You're worried about steroids? Kids are like, you cop.
Playing video games like Grand Theft Auto where you're killing cops.
That's worse influence, in my opinion, than steroids will ever be. And Barry Bonds hitting home runs. There's a big difference between a kid taking steroids as opposed to a grown man looking to perform better at a better level in sports. And where is Schwarzenegger in all this? I mean, he is the poster boy for steroids. He's the poster boy for, hey, look at me, look what I did. I came, I conquered, I kicked ass. That autobiography says he was doing it when he was 15, 16. Hey, he won a Mr. Universe at 19 years old. 19. Did you ever see what he looked like when he was 19? Do you think it was God-given genetics, or do you think that maybe he took the performance enhancers?
That's an excerpt from Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American. Chris Bell, writer and director, joins us on the phone. In studio with us, the writers and producers, Alex Buono and Tamsin Rawadi. Chris, how do the athletes that you spoke with in the film justify, or not, their steroid use?
I think that, you know, there's certain different examples. You know, my younger brother, who's a powerlifter, just basically said there's no excuse for being as strong as you can possibly be. In his mind, steroids are okay because everybody else in his sport particularly was doing it because there actually is no drug testing in that particular sport. I think that some of the other athletes, like Ben Johnson, for example, who was stripped of his gold medal from the 1988 Olympics, he just said, you know, you cheat, everybody cheats, and nobody's perfect, and that's just the way it is. And it's really kind of sad in a way that that's what we've been taught, is that this win-at-all-cost mentality that forces athletes to use steroids.
In the film, you say, I was raised to believe that cheaters never prosper, but in America, it seems that cheaters always prosper. What do you think that says about this nation, Chris?
That was something that actually my younger brother always says. He's like, what are you talking about? Cheaters always prosper. And so I decided to put that in the film as part of my voiceover because it was something that was you know, like I said, again, it was really sad to me to see that my parents always taught me not to take shortcuts and to work hard and to play by the rules. And, you know, Arnold in his speech says, if you work hard and play by the rules, you can achieve anything. So you have these politicians and these people telling you, look, work hard, play by the rules, don't cheat. And then they're cheating behind your back. So it's kind of like I wanted to pull the curtain back and show the world what was going on behind the scenes.
Mm. Alex Buono, you're the director of photography. And in this film, there's an interesting section about how photography itself is used to promote these performance-enhancing supplements and, in turn, the steroids themselves. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how particularly the before or after shots are done and how they're pretty deceptive?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the film covers a lot of ground, and it's not just about steroids and sports, and we do get into dietary supplements and the kinds of supplements that you see in the muscle magazines, and you go to the, you know, protein or the nutrition stores, and in the muscle magazines, you're constantly seeing these before and after ads that say, oh, and I got ripped in 12 weeks on this product, and Chris knows these guys. He knows the fitness models. He knows the people that make these ads. And he knows that actually the truth is that a lot of those before and after ads are taken in a day.
And Chris himself subjected himself to that treatment.
Absolutely. One of the more fun stunts that we do in the film is that we actually make our own dietary supplement to show just how unregulated and sketchy the dietary supplement industry is. And then Chris actually, in order to promote his own dietary supplement, makes his own before and after ad, which we actually shoot in one day and then Photoshop it, and it looks exactly like any ad that you'll see in any muscle magazine.
Hmm. Townsend, what do you expect viewers to take away from this film? I mean, it's about steroids, but it's about much more.
Yeah, it's about so much more. I mean, I think spending 3 years on this subject, I'm just shocked at how much I learned about not just steroids, but just the whole system in America and how things are done and how everybody's pretty much responsible for the reason that these athletes are using steroids. Basically, you know, from George Bush being the owner of the Texas Rangers, and then now saying, you know, that using steroids is, you know, pretty much un-American. And
our own governor here in California.
Governor Schwarzenegger. I mean, I think that here he is, a politician who could do something about this, but in his own bodybuilding competition that's called the Arnold, there is absolutely rampant use of steroids. And, you know, for me, it's like, how can kids look up to these people when there are these mixed messages that have been sent?
And finally, Chris Bell, do you think that it's going to take an entire sort of change in American culture, or, you know, does one have to sort of start with more regulation of the steroid industry without criminalizing athletes?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I don't know that it's ever going to stop. We take athletes and we put them on a pedestal and we say, that guy's a winner and he'll do anything to win. And that seems to be the message that we're sending. And as a kid, for me, you know, I grew up with kind of a void in my life saying, like, if I'm not like that, I'm not going to feel good about myself. And my brothers did as well. And I don't know that that's going to stop with regulation of steroids or anything. I think that, like, you're right, it'll take a cultural shift of people accepting themselves. And when I made the film, the one thing that I really learned was from my own mother, who said, you know, I don't know why you felt like you're not good enough. You have so many positive values in your life. And I realized I was a much better filmmaker than a power lifter or a bodybuilder. And I think that was real important for me, myself. I learned a lot from the film by making it.
Well, Chris Bell, I wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also thanks to Alex and Tamsin.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Chris Bell, writer and director of the film Bigger, Stronger, Faster, The Side Effects of Being American, Alex Buono and Tamsin Rawadi are both the writers and producers. Alex is also the director of photography. The film is opening tonight at the Pasadena Playhouse 7 Cinemas in L.A. at the Landmark, in Hollywood at the ArcLight Hollywood 15 and Irvine, California, University Town Center 6 Cinemas. And more information at BiggerStrongerFasterMovie.com. That's BiggerStrongerFasterMovie.com. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote Aldous Huxley, who once said, "In the person of our nation, we are able vicariously to bully and cheat. Bully and cheat, what's more, with a feeling that we are profoundly virtuous." That's Aldous Huxley, and that's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Have a wonderful weekend, and thanks so much for listening.